Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. I'd like to start by saying what an honor it is to be here today. This is actually my first oral argument on Zoom, as well as my first oral argument altogether. So I want to thank you all for taking the time to hear this case. What brings us here today, there was a verdict issued in 2017, State of Texas versus Francisco Delgado. In that case, Francisco Delgado was convicted of murder and sentenced to 99 years with a max fine of $10,000, where the trial court judge stacks that with a prior conviction of aggravated assault with 5 years. In that trial, it really comes down to just one issue that I kind of, expanded on in my brief. The issue is there was some extraneous offense evidence admitted at the guilt-innocent phase of this trial, and that had a substantial effect on the defendant's right to his fair trial. And basically, there was at least five instances, where the state used, in the guilt-innocence phase, this evidence to effectively turn the entire trial into one big punishment trial. There was an instance in the beginning where an officer who testified, Officer Kirksey, he testified that DNA was collected from Francisco Delgado, and he also testified that DNA was only collected from felons. There was an instance where a prior conviction, the judgment of the prior conviction, was admitted during the guilt-innocence phase of Francisco Delgado, a time where he had been convicted of an aggravated assault with a deadly weapon.
Counsel, but if I may interrupt you.
Yes, ma'am.
Isn't it correct that self-defense was raised as an issue in voir dire, and wouldn't then the state be allowed the opportunity to raise this extraneous offense in their case in chief? In other words, wasn't the door already opened?
I'm glad you asked that, Your Honor. So generally, yes, actually. So I'd like to point out that the first mention of self-defense was actually proffered by the state in this case during voir dire. But yes, Your Honor, the door can be opened, and that's one of the issues I'd like to get to. So when the defendant raises the issue of self-defense, that there is an instance where they open the door for rebuttal evidence. And in this case specifically, that's what the state argued at the trial level that they were doing by showing this prior conviction and these other instances that were brought up. But there is precedent for this as well. But the precedent, it's very important to note, Your Honor. So when the defense raises self-defense, it opens the door so the state can bring in prior convictions. The precedent that we have seen, though, there is a causal nexus. So to really get into this, Your Honor, you have to break it down into several subparts. First, we need to check to see if the evidence is relevant. In determining the relevancy, we get into the kind of subcategory of the 404B, the character evidence. If it passes that, then there's also the exception under 403 that the judge at the trial court level needs to do a balancing test. So 401 basically is something relevant. Does it make a fact of consequence more or less probable? Okay. 404B.
So, Mr. DeLeon, so if we do the first analysis, which of course is the relevancy analysis, are we looking specifically, because you've mentioned right now that there are a matter of actually four different things, the rap sheet, the testimony from the police officer, the DNA blood work. But when we're looking at relevancy, do we have to look at them each individually as to whether they're relevant at the time that they're allowed in? Or are we looking at just, are they relevant? Because some of them just prove that he's a convicted felon, and some of them as to the causal nexus is that he stabbed someone, and we have a stabbing incident here in which he's claiming self-defense. So how do we do that analysis of the relevancy as it pertains to each of the evidentiary objections that you're making?
Your Honor, we would need to do them individually as they come about. So for instance, there is this prior conviction that was admitted, this judgment of a prior conviction. It was admitted in the guilt-innocence phase, and the several cases propounded by the state also, we can see that there are instances where this is allowed to rebut the theory of self-defense, because in the cases provided in the state's brief, you can see that there were there was challenging to rebut the intent of self-defense, which in those cases it might seem relevant, but also there is precedent that shows that there needs to be a nexus for that piece of evidence. So, for example, for this judgment to come in, Your Honor, the way it came about at trial was the state introduced this. Here's a prior conviction for an aggravated assault based off stabbing. Now he's being tried for a murder based off stabbing. Now let's move on to the next piece of evidence. There was no background facts. There was no witness testimony. The victim of an aggravated assault case did not testify whether or not he was the first aggressor, or if Francisco Delgado claimed self-defense. None of that came in, Judge. So there is no causal nexus. On its face, it would seem that it was just there to show that Francisco Delgado was a felon and a bad person generally, and that he was guilty of that aggravated assault prior to this occasion, and therefore he should be guilty of this murder within a similar fashion with the stabbing.
Mr. Delio, let me ask you, in each of those cases, did in fact he conduct a balancing test? Are you arguing that he did not do that, or was that done?
It was not done on the record, Your Honor. I believe the case law implies that if they don't, the case law reflects that if the judge just at the trial court level does not put that on the record, it's implied that he has conducted one, internally. So there is not one on the record, Your Honor. However, whenever we are reviewing the balancing test under 403, this is taken under review by an abuse of discretion standard. So basically what we're here arguing, Judge, as the defense for the appellant, is that there was an abuse of discretion in allowing this to come in. And it's not just, I like to emphasize, the one of the bigger parts of this oral argument, at least from our standpoint, is it's while the prior conviction is a big part, it's a very large part of what we're arguing should not have come in, it's not the only part. There were these five instances I was intimating at earlier. There was testimony about the DNA being collected only by felons that was allowed in. There was also a detective that testified to the prior convictions. There was a rap sheet from the prior conviction of Francisco Delgado. And then last but not least, there was an instance where the state and defense counsel at trial agreed to redact a video that was to be played in front of the jury of an interview of the defendant, because in this case the defendant did not testify. However, the state introduced evidence of an interview through the detective, and specifically what was agreed upon by the parties was that this video would be redacted to start at a point after which the defendant Francisco Delgado stated that he was currently on probation, which implies that he was already a convicted felon. The parties agreed to that. And then, of course, outside the presence of the jury, when the jury was brought back in, the video was played. And the very first thing you hear is, "I'm on probation." It was played before the jury. And that part is on the record, actually. The trial court judge, it's on the record. He says he heard it. The jury heard it.
Mr. De Leon, did that occur in the punishment phase or in the guilt or innocence phase?
Oh, this is all guilt innocence, Your Honor.
Okay. Counsel,
yes, ma'am.
I assume I'll let you continue, but I do want of you course. To get to the second prong, which is even if Yeah, because the state is arguing that even if there was an error, that there was, it wasn't harmful because the evidence was overwhelming, you know, that your client committed the crime. And so I do want you to get to that, but you control your time. I just want you to have sufficient time to address that.
Of course, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. So the harm, the analysis for there is that there needs to be a fair assurance that there was but a slight effect of all of this evidence coming in at the guilt-innocence phase. Basically, he received the max punishment possible in this case. The defendant, Francisco Delgado, received 99 years with a max fine of $10,000, which the trial court stacked with a prior offense. It doesn't get more severe than that in this type of case, that was the max possible, and that's what he got. So
are you saying that? Go ahead, Justice Hinojosa.
Well, I'm asking you, would the end result have been different? Well, what as far as the guilt or innocence, don't you think there's the evidence is pretty overwhelming that the crime was committed? That maybe since the bulk of these objections this evidence was in the guilt or innocence phase. Are you just arguing that he maybe not have gotten the 99 years? He would have still been found guilty, but the result would have been different as far as the length of incarceration.
Well, yes, Your Honor, it is possible. So there was other evidence that the state could have used. And Your Honor, that actually brings a very good point under the 403 analysis, because under the 403 analysis, one of the factors to be considered when doing the balancing test is the state's need for that evidence. The state didn't need this prior conviction, Your Honor. The state, they introduced this evidence, but there was other evidence out there to refute the theory of self-defense. There were eyewitnesses at this bar that testified that the defendant threw the first punch. And there was DNA evidence inside and outside of the bar of both the defendant and the victim. Basically, there was no dire need for the state to introduce this. And by introducing this prior conviction, along with the other instances I just mentioned, the jury was allowed to contemplate all of this evidence for a much longer period of time at the guilt-innocence phase, opposed to it not being introduced until the punishment phase, assuming that it would get that far. It's kind of like that saying, Your Honor, if you've ever heard it, if you boil a frog, you do it slowly, because if you boil some water and you drop a frog in there, it's going to hop right out. But if you put a frog in there and you do it slowly, little by little, it's going to sit in there and acclimate and get cooked. And that's essentially what happened here, Your Honor.
So are you saying that the discussion of the five evidentiary points that you bring to us about him being on probation and a convicted felon, along with his rap sheet and his own testimony without any true balancing test, allows this jury to give him maybe just not guilty, but gave him the maximum sentences. That's what's showing you the harm.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Was there a self-defense instruction given to this jury? I forgot to look.
Yes, ma'am, there was.
And so the jury found found negative in the self-defense instruction?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, now let's talk about the limiting instruction. The trial court did put a limiting instruction in the jury charge regarding that extraneous offense. Wasn't that enough to cure any concerns regarding character conformity?
Your Honor, there was a limiting instruction. However, I don't believe it suffices in this instance. Had there just been a passing reference or something along those lines, I think that might have done the trick. But when you have this emphasis throughout the case, beginning all the way from voir dire, really, to closing arguments, it's just too much to be undone at that point. And at that point, it's basically this defendant is being tried for not only this case that he is charged with presently, but being tried for everything he's done up until that point.
Hey, would you agree then, though, if one of those instances would overcome your challenge, let's say that uh, if if you didn't meet your burden on the objection for the introduction of the judgment, well, the judgment brings on all the information. Would then it make the other points moot, the other four or the other five? Because you're talking about each one being a felon, and that I'm not sure if you're saying the accumulation of all of them, because they're really all just talking about one thing. So if one of those pieces of evidence was allowed to come in, then really wouldn't all of them be able to come in?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the most controlling would be the judgment. That appears to be the more powerful of the evidence, the extraneous offense evidence that came in. However, I would still argue that it shouldn't come in, because the precedent we have seen, Your Honor, from the cases cited, the extraneous offense evidence that had come in had live testimony from the victims of other cases or people with personal knowledge of those cases, which entails the defense safeguards, which are constitutionally enabled. Here, we don't get any of that kind of protection. There's nobody with personal knowledge to be cross-examined or impeached or attempted to be impeached at that point.
Okay.
All right. Are there any further questions, Justice Hinojosa, Justice Tejerina? All right, your time is up. Mr. De Leon, we will now hear from the state and Mr. Norman.
Thank you, Judge.
Thank you, Your Honor. Doug Norman for the state. The first thing I'd like to mention, Your Honor, is I believe, and Mr. De Leon mentioned several different instances as if we were taking each separate, but if I'm reading his brief correctly, you know, the one thing he seems to be complaining about is the aggravated assault judgment. I mean, everything in the brief seems to point to that rather than to the other instances. So that was my main argument, was against that aggravated assault judgment and why that
well,
was
off over
the state.
I think that the problem occurs in this case is that I think if it was just the aggravated assault, Mr. Norman, the Halliburton cases and the Guerra case would, you know, kind of win the day for you. But what we have before us is just a rap sheet that says he's a convicted felon without a specific thing. The DNA work from Felons Only and the testimony from the officer that just talks about him being a felon and not really addressing the rebuttal issue of why you allow extraneous offenses under 404. So I think that's the issue that I read into the brief, Mr. Norman, that the appellant brought forward.
Certainly, I know it was mentioned in the brief. I didn't read that as being sort of brought into his specific arguments. I would tend to agree with Justice Tiarina that it's all really geared toward the aggravated assault that was brought in. And I mean, the state's argument is geared toward that. And I think I would join Justice Tiarina in suggesting that all of the other various instances, if we got the aggravated assault in because he raised self-defense and we were entitled to rebut that, then I think all of the other instances would sort of fall in line under that. At least they would be harmless error because we already have the underlying aggravated assault judgment there. But I could be wrong, but the tenor of the brief indicated to me that he was arguing about that particular judgment coming in, both when he talks about error preservation and when he talks about the merits of the error itself. And so my central argument here has to do with why I think under Halliburton, we were certainly entitled to do that. We were certainly entitled to bring in the extraneous offense to rebut the self-defense argument, which if you look at the Halliburton case and the other cases that followed it, it's a pretty blanket rule. It allows us, once they've raised self-defense, to bring in other extraneous offenses, other aggravated or other murders, other aggravated assaults, at this point to rebut that defense. And they don't really, I'm sorry.
Well, I agree with you, Mr. Norman, that pretty much opens the door these other extraneous offenses in. But I think that even the Halliburton cases and the cases that come after it still say there has to be a balancing test, which is what Justice DeHanina was talking about. There doesn't have to be a hearing by the court, but the court still has to make an analysis of whether its probative value outweighs its prejudicial factor and whether that extraneous offense has to do anything with the underlying case in this set. For in this case, the stabbing. I mean, you wouldn't go in and come in and put that, you know, he was a drug dealer, because that wouldn't have anything to do with this right. case, unless there was some kind of drug deal gone bad. So, I mean, there's still a test that the trial court to undergo.
I would agree with that, Your Honor. As far as the balancing, I mean, I think I would separate it out. The first question is it relevant? Is it admissible under 404B?
Right.
And in that case, I think if, as long as you have an aggravated offense, a violent offense, then you can say the nexus is that we have a violent offense there, which could be read to rebut claims of self-defense in another violent offense. Whether, you know, whether it was an aggravated assault or a murder, the nexus is you have one violent offense in the past, which may be used to draw some inferences about whether or not the defendant truly did or did not have a valid self-defense argument in this case, whether he apprehended the necessity for doing the action that he did. As far as the balancing test, I mean, that's a separate question. Once you get over the initial hurdle to say, okay, this is acceptable under 404B, then you go to 403. Under that, you have to look at a whole host of factors, which, you know, Mr. De Leon suggests that we didn't meet that factor test. I suggest that the defendant, the trial court is given a great deal of discretion under 403. And, you know, part of it does have to do with the strength of, you know, our need for the testimony. One of the things in this case that I think, you know, is critical is even though there were several people that saw the fight, nobody saw the knife. Nobody actually saw the stabbing. And it was critical if he was going to claim he had to use that knife in self-defense. I think it was certainly relevant for us to point out that he's had these this prior aggravated assault. That's certainly, you know, the only evidence we have is his saying I was doing it in self-defense and circumstantial evidence that he was not. I think in cases like that, we didn't have anybody come in and say, I saw it and it was, you know, when he pulled the knife, he started stabbing this person. All we had was a fight between the two of them and then people who saw the results of that fight afterwards. So this was a case where I think we needed the evidence as one additional.
Mr. Norman, I did find that was different in this case compared to almost all the other cases. In all the other cases, the defendant testified as to self-defense, starting with the Halliburton case. In this case, the defendant did not testify. He was relying on the testimony he gave and the other testimony from other witnesses who talked about how the victim was the first aggressor in this fight when it started inside the bar. Does that matter in trying to put this extraneous offense in when the defendant himself, because in Halliburton, they talk about how we don't want the defendant's testimony to mislead the jury. So it's required to have this rebuttal testimony in order to not have a misleading portion to the jury. Since he didn't testify here, why was it so necessary to have the extraneous offense?
Well, even though he didn't testify, the only basis for his defense was the statements itself. If he hadn't made the statements, if he hadn't raised self-defense in some manner, then I don't think we would see any defense at all. It was quite clear that it was either self-defense or he really had no defense at all to it. Self-defense was raised by his statements. And the statements themselves, you know, we may say, well, he didn't testify and therefore it shouldn't carry as much weight as cases where the defendant does testify. But the fact is that's all he had. And the only way we could rebut it was with counter evidence. So, I mean, the fact that in Halliburton, it was based on testimony, and in this case, it was based on statements, I'm not sure that that really makes any difference as far as the state's necessity to try to rebut his statements one way or another, whether they're statements made out of court or statements in court. The state still has to, in some way, rebut his statements. We can do it with the circumstantial evidence, which we think was pretty strong against it, regardless, but we think that this was a fair way to try to rebut those statements and that it was necessary for us to do it. And in a sense, I realized that it's sort of cutting both ways because on one hand, we do need it. I think, you know, there's an argument to be made that we needed it in trial. On the other hand, when you get to the harm analysis, you know, I am going to be arguing that I think we had overwhelming evidence regardless of that.
Counselor, it seems to me, reading your brief, that you are sort of contradicting yourself, because in your harm analysis, you basically say that you do have, that it's harmless because there is sufficient evidence that had already been admitted. I'm trying to kind of piece that together or with your other arguments, but my recollection was there was an eyewitness. Wasn't there an eyewitness that maybe did not see the actual penetration of the knife with the body, but basically, saw, I guess, the other woman, the patron that was out in the parking lot, pretty much could saw the altercation and then the aftermath. And then there was forensic evidence, and there was evidence. My recollection was that the evidence was that the defendant did throw the first punch, approached the victim, and had a confrontation with him at the bar, and then followed him out. So don't you think that all that would point that this evidence of this extraneous offense is really superfluous would really had no bearing, at least on the guilt or innocence phase, so really was unnecessary?
Well, I would agree that we had overwhelming evidence against the defendant, but I think maybe when you're looking at it in terms of 703, it's not just whether we did or didn't have overwhelming evidence, but it's kind of the character of the evidence. This was the only evidence aside from essentially circumstantial evidence, because like I say, nobody actually saw the stabbing. This was the only evidence aside from, a certain categories of circumstantial evidence that we had to suggest what his intent might have been. So, I mean, even though it was overwhelming, we think the evidence was overwhelming, still, I think the state is entitled, even in overwhelming evidence cases, if there's a different kind of evidence, one that would point in the direction that we're trying to obviously point the jury, it's important that we get all of the various kinds of evidence, categories of evidence that we can. And that, I think, maybe is the distinction between looking at it in a 403 context and looking at it in a harmless error context.
And counsel, most of this evidence was admitted all in the guilt or innocence phase, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the only thing we're arguing.
Okay. So you had already, you'd already won on the conviction. So you'd already proven that the murder had occurred, and the jury had already found that his self-defense argument did not hold water, because they'd found that in the guilt or innocence, that's where they considered self-defense. So why keep piling on more evidence in the guilt or innocence phase about prior convictions when you've already proven your the guilt of this particular defendant?
Well, we as the state, I mean, if we have the evidence to use, we never get too comfortable that the jury is going to, believe the evidence we have, even when we think it's overwhelming. And so I think we have the right, like I say, as long as it's of a different character, to go ahead and present that evidence. And juries can be unpredictable. They might give much more weight to one type of evidence than to another. And so I think we have to, we have to have the ability to present all of the evidence that we can that might, one juror might find it extremely relevant that this guy had a prior conviction for aggravated assault and might be bothered by the fact that there was no eyewitness to the actual stabbing. Some jurors are like that. And that's why I think we need to present all of the evidence that we can.
But you'd already had a finding of guilty. You'd already had a refusal for the jury to accept self-defense. And yet in the punishment phase, it appears that's when the state really honed in on priors. And wouldn't that sort of imply that what the state was intending to do was to maximize the sentence so that the jury could consider all the priors as a factor on, whether this guy was, a good candidate for probation or a lesser sentence?
I may be misunderstanding, Your Honor, but I mean, it was my understanding that we're dealing only with the guilt innocence phase, in the punishment phase, we would be entitled to bring the aggravated assault. And there's no question it would be relevant to the punishment phase.
So okay. It's
my understanding, we're just looking at guilt innocence here.
Okay. And that's why, I guess, and that's what they're trying to say is that since it was brought up in voir dire, they already had it in the back of their mind. And so when it got to the guilt or innocence, that's what I was trying to figure out, because I thought that it was admissible at that point because it was a prior conviction. But I guess their only argument is that it sort of colored their thinking throughout the trial, I guess.
I mean, mm-hmm. I wouldn't disagree, Your Honor.
Yeah.
If I may, I'm sorry, are there other questions? There were a couple things when I read over the brief that I thought were kind of important that I may not have hit on strongly. And one of them is why I think Halliburton was decided the way it was, because I can kind of sympathize with some of the trouble that Mr. DeLeon has with Halliburton with some of these cases, because I understand that in some ways it looks like we're getting around the rule. As soon as you have a self-defense argument, it looks like what we're saying is, okay, all bets are off and you can present this character evidence now. I think there's a way around that, because I think the prohibition on character evidence is based on using character evidence. If you read 404B, it's using character evidence to show the defendant acted in conformity with that character. And once you have self-defense, which is a confession and avoidance defense, his actions are no longer relevant. I mean, he's essentially admitted to the actions. And all we're looking at is a mental state, his intent during those actions. And that's, I think, the way, although it wasn't expressed that way in Halliburton and the other cases, that's really what's at issue here. We're no longer trying to prove that he acted in conformity with his prior convictions. Now we're going into his intent, what was in his mind at the time. And in reading through it, I see nothing that says you can't use his prior acts as an indication of his character with regard to what he intended. In other words, whether he intended his actions in self-defense or whether he intended them as simply a murder. The other interesting question I think that's raised that I didn't really fully get into was the fact that we already had a trial court who made the essential decision about harmless error. And as I know, a couple of you were trial judges yourselves before you ascended the bench. And when we have the determination by a trial court who was there and able to see what happened, I think that's entitled at least some weight in the harmless error. And I'm sorry, I'm out of time. I apologize.
No, that's fine, Mr. Norman. You're making some good points. Do I have any further questions from Justice Inhofe or Justice Tijanina? All right, Mr. DeLeon, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So there's lots of discussion about the Halliburton case. I like to point out, I believe that case was from 1975. But also there was a strong dissent by Chief Justice Roberts in there that was very, very eye-catching. And basically, he was arguing that there was improper emphasis in that case because in Halliburton, what had happened basically was that there was a man and a woman, husband and wife, and the wife shot and killed the husband. She claimed self-defense. And then the state brought in another man who had been shot by the wife as well. And basically Chief Justice Roberts said there was no motive. And he cited a case, I can't remember the name of the case inside of Halliburton, but he cited a case that said there was no additional factor of the motive that they were citing. And that's important because to rebut that, they did not have the similar motive against a class of persons. For example, it wasn't the wife shooting the husband's lover multiple times, like different lovers on different occasions, some kind of causal nexus. There wasn't that as well. And he says, absent that motive, what really is happening is there's not enough distinguishing characteristics that show the similarity of these cases, and that basically it's being used to show the bad character of the defendants and that he's a criminal generally. He actually dissented twice. He dissented furthermore. I believe he had one of the other justices backing him up both times. But he also dissented again, saying that look, by going down this route, we're creating a one-sided scale. We're forcing defendants to essentially forfeit their right to claim self-defense. And that's a very strong dissent of the Chief Justice at that time. I just wanted to point that out. And since then, that was a 1975 case. Since then, we've had many, many cases decided using a similar rule, but they all have had a causal nexus. There's been a case, Johnson, which I cited in my brief, I believe it's out of Texarkana, where the defendant shot somebody who, I'm sorry, where the defendant had, oh, that wasn't Johnson, excuse me. There's a case, Johnson, where there's a causal nexus where the defendant has shot somebody in order to move up in a gang rank. The defendant had shot somebody, and the state used extraneous offense evidence to show that he had previously assaulted that same victim. So there was a causal nexus of being the same victim there. There's also another case, there's cases and cases out there, but there's another case out there that shows that there was motive for the defense to commit this offense, and they used the extraneous offense evidence to show that he had been doing these things to move up the ranks within a gang. So motive was an issue there. There are all these different factors in there that have been decided since 1975 when the Halliburton case was decided, and that establishes the precedent. I'd like to touch on some points mentioned by the Appellee's counsel, that the evidence in this case was necessary because nobody saw the knife. And then they mentioned that intent is what's at issue, not the actions. If those were very important, they should have brought the victim in from that prior aggravated assault case to testify to those things, because that victim was there, and he was the subject of that prior aggravated assault. He wouldn't know the facts better than anyone, and he could bring forth these distinguishing characteristics, like in the dissent Chief Justice Roberts mentioned. He could say, no, there was, you know, he attacked me first. You know, at trial, he tried to say, I did it, but the jury didn't believe him. He was convicted of the aggravated assault. And that was not done. Simply, the state offered this prior conviction. There was no mention of self-defense whatsoever in that case, which is very important because that's what's being brought upon to compare to this case. So saying that was necessary in that regard, if it were necessary, we should have had that testimony brought forth, just like in the prior cases we have seen in the precedent.
All right, Mr. DeLeon, anything else from Justice? Then this case will stand as submitted until further notice from the court. Thank you.